This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Today we're talking about the Electoral College. Conversations about the value and impact of the Electoral College almost always pop up right after a presidential election. And we wanted to catch up on where people and the political parties stand on the issue. If you have questions or comments on our show today, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail. Call us at 866-476-3881. We just need your name, where you're calling from, and a quick question or comment, and we will do our best to get it into the conversation. Again, that's 866-476-3881. You can also send us a high-quality voice message with our smartphone app called All In Vox Pop, which is free and very easy to use. Just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store. We're joined now by two guests. Leslie Lenkowski is a professor emeritus in public affairs and philanthropy at Indiana University. Leslie, welcome.
Thank you.
Marjorie Hershey is a professor emeritus of political science, also at IU. Marjorie Hershey, welcome to you. Leslie, before we get into the details, can you explain what the Electoral College is in basic terms for people who might not be familiar?
Yes, the Electoral College is basically consists of electors apportioned among the states. Each state has a number of electors equal to the total of their senators and congressmen currently. And the electors come together to vote for the president. The Constitution doesn't specify on what basis they should vote, but all states, basically, the electors cast their ballots in light of the popular vote in each state.
And so then the intent behind the Electoral College is I guess, what? It's to apportioned voice to states that might not otherwise have as big a voice?
Actually, it's part of a larger set of issues designed to really protect individual rights. We're all very familiar with, for example, separation of powers as one check on an active national government. This is another. It's not as well understood, but basically the idea is that candidates for president have to not only appeal to the public at large, but appeal in 50 different states, plus the District of Columbia, and fashion a majority among those states. So you have what John Calhoun said in the 19th century, the need for some sort of concurrent majority. It's not simple. It's not a simple majority of all people casting votes, but majorities in a majority of the states, in effect.
Marjorie Hershey, what effect does the Electoral College have on Indiana?
Well, it certainly convinces an awful lot of Hoosiers that their ballots don't make any difference. You know, if you are voting either Republican or Democratic in Indiana, it doesn't much matter because of the fact that Indiana, we know, will choose a slate of Republican electors because there will be a plurality of Republican votes for the president in Indiana. That's a problem. A lot of people feel, why should I take part in this? Because it really has no impact on the outcome.
Well, if I could point out, though, that in 2008, Barack Obama actually carried Indiana. And even though in most presidential elections recently, Indiana will be in the Republican column, nonetheless, there's still an incentive for candidates, particularly Republican candidates, but also Democrats who think they have a chance to come here to try and capture the state's electoral vote. If it were just a matter of population in the nation as a whole, Indiana would have even less influence because we're a small state.
And so this exchange here sort of illustrates where each of you are on the issue. Leslie Lenkowski, you seem to be in favor of the Electoral College. Marjorie Hershey, you seem to be critical of it. Marjorie, does, from your perspective, does the Electoral College seem to benefit one political party over the other when you look at the whole country?
Well, empirically, yes. Let me just suggest, and I do this with respect, that I don't do this to take a position for or against the Electoral College, but rather simply to explain what its impact is as a social scientist. And as a social scientist, I've seen that over time, in the mid-1900s, the Electoral College had a pro-democratic bias in the sense that those states that benefit those that were smaller in population, that tended to be dominated by one party, were largely one-party Democratic. That was the time when we had a solid Democratic South. Since that time, largely because of the issue of civil rights and the two parties' changes in stands on that issue, the Electoral College now has a slight benefit to to Republicans, to the point where we've seen empirically that a Democrat such as Joe Biden normally has to win a popular vote majority of upwards of 4 to 5 percentage points in order to win a bare majority of the Electoral College vote. And that's because the states that benefit from the Electoral College, the one-party, smaller population states, are largely Southern, which are largely Republican now.
Still, it's also, I think, worth noting that there have only been 5 times in our history where the winner of the popular vote did not win a majority of the Electoral College, and none of those times occurred in the 20th century. We had 3 instances in the 19th century, one involving Indianapolis's own Benjamin Harrison. And then in this century, we've had 2, the race between Al Gore and George W. Bush, and of course, the race between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. This year, Vice President Biden will be the winner of both the popular vote and the Electoral College vote, and his margin in the Electoral College will be greater than his margin in the popular vote.
That's true. I think it's important to keep in mind, though, Les, that after all, those 2 elections in the 2000s have been 2 elections out of 6. That's not a small number.
But we're also a different country now, a more polarized country. People, we think, are more likely to vote along party affiliations. There are a lot of things that have changed. The Electoral College hasn't changed all that much, a couple of small changes, but it's really the underlying political structure of the country that's at issue here.
So, Leslie, I guess in order to preserve the Electoral College, it could be, I guess, adjusted. How often is it adjusted to reflect the electorate of each state, or is it often enough?
Well, it reflects the number of representatives and senators in each state. So ultimately, the size of the Electoral College depends on the size of both chambers of Congress. There are some very interesting proposals now that suggest a modest increase in the number of congressmen, members of the House of Representatives, to better reflect the increased population of the United States. If that was to, were to be enacted, say we add 20 new congressmen to the House of Representatives, that would change the Electoral College as well, and move it slightly in the direction of the more populous states.
Leslie, how, I guess, would you, and we've touched on this a little bit so far, but how would you characterize the disagreement around the Electoral College as it stands right now? I mean, what do the sides for it and against it argue? And Marjorie, I'll get your opinion afterward.
Well, I think those against the Electoral College really think that the majority should determine who the president is. It is certainly the case that there is the possibility that a small, something less than a candidate who receives less than a majority of the vote can still be elected president. And we saw that 4 years ago. Those defending the Electoral College, though, are concerned that if it were a nationwide popular vote, there would be a variety of practical difficulties. For example, candidates might campaign intensively in the most populous states and pay much less attention to the less populous ones. Or you might have multiple candidates reflecting various specific interests within the population. So the concern that people who defend the Electoral College worry about is the possibility that a nationwide popular vote may ultimately lead to the election of a candidate who really doesn't command a majority of the nation.
Marjorie, how would you respond to that? I hear that argument that that flyover states would be flyover for presidential candidates who might just focus on the coasts were it otherwise.
Well, it may well be, but let me just suggest, I think Professor Lenkowski has done a good job of setting out the points of view. But in practice, I hope this doesn't jump you too far ahead on your questions, it's going to be almost impossible to change. First of all, because this is a part of the Constitution, and you know that it's an extraordinary process that it takes to change the Constitution. And second, just simply because the types of changes that have been proposed, one of them is to eliminate the Electoral College entirely. One of them is to bypass the idea of a constitutional amendment, the necessity of a constitutional amendment, by simply having a compact among states in which they say, okay, since we're the ones who get to decide how to choose the electors, we are going to divide our electoral votes between the two major candidates according to the percentages of the popular vote that they receive. Or we're going to give all of our electoral votes to whichever candidate won the most popular votes. Both of those compacts have been floated for a very long time right now. Neither one of them is the slightest bit likely, simply because of the fact that the first states to do that would give up the advantage that the party now has in that state continues to have. If, for example, Indiana is a highly Republican state and all of the Indiana electoral votes now go to the Republican candidate, if the Indiana state legislature were to say, well, okay, let's divide up the Indiana electoral vote and
10 seconds, Marjorie, sorry. We'll be back with our guests after a quick break. Sorry to interrupt. We are talking about the impact of the Electoral College on U.S. elections and the arguments for and against the system. And we will be back with more in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. We're talking today about the impact of the Electoral College on elections in the United States and the ongoing conversations around whether it has a positive effect. And we would love your questions and comments on the topic. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. 866-476-3881. We would love to hear your voice in the conversation today. You can also do that through our All In Vox Pop app. Just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store. Send us your question or comment that way, and we'll try to get it into the show. And we have with us today Leslie Lenkowski, Professor Emeritus in Public Affairs and Philanthropy at Indiana University, and Marjorie Hershey, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Indiana University. And Marjorie Hershey, just before the break, we were talking a little bit. I want to focus on, and you can come back to some of those points if you'd like, but I want to look at the 2016 election. Attention toward the Electoral College really flared up after that election. For some, it was evidence that the system doesn't work, as was 2000 when Al Gore won the popular vote, but George W. Bush won the Electoral College. Others see those reactions as reactionary, I guess, that some people just want the system changed when it would have helped their candidate win. What do you think of these kinds of responses and how attitudes around the Electoral College might be influenced by specific situations?
Well, I think it's almost inevitable when you have a political system that is as strongly polarized as ours is. As we can see right now, we have a situation in which members of one party whose candidate lost are claiming that their candidate, in fact, didn't lose. That really has very little to do with objective reality. It does have an awful lot to do with the fact that people have a very strong emotional response to the party that they favor, that the polarization is such that most people are involved in favoring one party very strongly, and that the result is people are inevitably going to be looking at this from the perspective of, is my party going to win or lose as a result?
Leslie, I want to pose kind of the same line of questioning to you. I mean, how much of an impact do you think specific election outcomes have on opinions about the Electoral College?
Well, what's really very interesting is that even though you're absolutely right, there was concern expressed about the Electoral College after 2016 and 2000. The closest we have ever come to actually abolishing the Electoral College in recent memory was in 1969, following the 1968 election, when Richard Nixon eked out a very small margin, about 500,000 nationwide, over Hubert Humphrey and a third party candidate, George Wallace. The following year, the House of Representatives passed a resolution with over 300 congressmen, meaning from both parties, supporting it to abolish the Electoral College and adopt a system developed by the American Bar Association. That did not pass the Senate, and of course, as a constitutional amendment, it would have had to be approved by the states as well. So I think the difficulties are hard. But for despite the concerns of 2016 and 2000, we've really not come close since 1969 to abolishing the Electoral College. And even, and that's, I mean, if you look at polls and Americans have been asked repeatedly, well over a majority of Americans say they're in favor of abolishing the Electoral College. But it doesn't happen, and I think there are good reasons that are well understood in Congress and elsewhere for that.
And Leslie, I want to share with you a comment that we got from Facebook from a listener named Ellen. She writes, living in Indiana and generally voting a mostly Democratic ticket, I've never felt like my vote counts. The argument that small states would feel neglected during the campaign also doesn't hold water because Indiana 99% of the time goes Republican and the Republicans can count on it. You don't ever see Indiana considered a battleground state. We're pretty ignored except for fundraising. Yes, we went for Obama in 2008. But that was a rare occurrence. The Electoral College has lost its usefulness and no longer makes sense. So a charged opinion from Ellen on Facebook, but any response to that?
Well, that is true, although it's changeable, as the Obama victory suggests. But it's also the case, and we just saw it this last go-round, that states, including in the Midwest, do flip. Michigan, Wisconsin have flipped. Ohio, until recently, used to vote Democratic. It now looks reliably Republican. The point, of course, is that if Indiana, if we went to a system that elected presidents by a nationwide popular vote, the amount of attention to Indiana might be even less than it is now, because our population is so small compared even to our neighboring states like Illinois, Michigan, and Ohio. There's no perfect solution, and the founding fathers in the Constitutional Convention understood this, but some solutions may be worse than others.
Marjorie, please go ahead.
Let me suggest that I think that the basic question here is one of majority rule. If we were to go down and see if there happen to be any groups of people who still gather outside these days and ask them, what's a democracy all about? the chances are a good chunk of them would say, well, democracy means majority rule. The thing is, the American democracy doesn't mean majority rule. And I think there's a really good argument that it was never intended to. I think that the writers of the Constitution built in one principle after another to try to limit the ability for majority rule to take effect, to try to limit the possibility that what the writers consider to be fleeting popular majorities could take over public policy for a particular period of time. The simple fact of separation of powers, which is probably the most basic element of our Constitution, means that it makes it harder for a majority at any given time to be able to work its will because of the fact that there are two houses of Congress to deal with, that the Congress is separate from the executive, which is separate from the judiciary. The Senate, obviously, is not a majoritarian institution because the states with huge populations are represented exactly the same as the states with the smallest populations. It's perfectly understandable why the folks who wrote the Constitution were anxious about majority rule. First of all, because there wasn't any country at the time that had it, and that sounded like a pretty radical proposition. And second, because they feared it might be used against them, that they might, in fact, end up being people whose property and influence would be limited by other people who may not know as much or have the responsibility as much as they did. So this was intentional as a part of our Constitution. We are not really a majority rule country, and that's a big reason why we have the Electoral College.
I think, though, that that somewhat mischaracterizes what the Founding Fathers were trying to do. They weren't in favor of minority rule. They were in favor of majority rule, but they wanted it to be a complex majority rule because they saw the United States as a complex society with many different kinds of interests. So in order to pass a law, you need majorities in two houses of Congress, not just one. In order to be elected president of the United States, you need majorities in a majority of the states, not just one majority across the entire country. I could argue whether or not that conception of majority rule is better than or worse than a more simplified conception. But I think that's what the idea of the Constitution was all about, which is basically to say to the majorities in the United States, slow down. You really need to have a majority of majorities in order to get your will expressed.
Well, I think that's we're both saying the same thing, and I accept your point that the purpose was to slow down, to put limits on majority rule. So we don't have a straight majority rule system. A lot of people wish that we did, except they usually don't wish that when they're in the minority. And then they're perfectly happy to have some limits on majority rule. So that means that this is always going to be a contentious subject, and it's always going to be a partisan subject.
We're talking today about the impact of the Electoral College on U.S. elections and the arguments for and against the system with Marjorie Hershey, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Indiana University, and Leslie Linkowski, Professor Emeritus in Public Affairs and Philanthropy at Indiana University. Professor Linkowski, what about the possibility, however unlikely, of electors going rogue? This is raised almost every 4 years. Electors not going along with what their states, where their states went, I guess.
Yeah, that's always a possibility. We call this the faithless elector problem, that somebody will not vote in accord with a majority of his or her states. But it's happened very rarely in American history. I think you could probably count the number of times on both fingers and toes in total. In any case, if we were really concerned about faithless electors, we could easily change that without changing the Electoral College. The Constitution actually does not specify how electors in the Electoral College should vote. It leaves that up to the states. If we wanted to change that, we could.
That's true. And it's also, it certainly is the case that cases of faithless electors are rare for a reason, and that's that they're typically appointed by the political party in that state that that expects or hopes that it's going to get its electoral vote slate sent to Washington. So it's pretty rare that a state party is going to appoint somebody as an elector who they're not sure of the sentiments of.
Leslie, do you think we should prohibit faithless electors somehow?
I don't think the problem is large enough throughout our history to take that step. Passing a constitutional amendment, which is what would be required, not only takes a lot of effort in the legislature and across the states, but we've usually reserved the amendment process for very significant issues, the right of certain groups to vote or to enjoy civil rights, how you replace a president who's incapacitated. This one could become a big problem, but we haven't seen that yet, and so I don't think it's necessary to amend the Constitution.
Leslie, how does the Electoral College affect how political candidates behave during election campaigns?
Well, it's going to force them to go visit places they may not otherwise visit if those places are potentially can wind up in their column. We did see examples of this in the last election. For example, no one was quite sure how Florida would vote. Florida, of course, wound up narrowly in Donald Trump's column in 2016. But this year, the candidates weren't quite sure. So we saw former President Obama campaigning in Florida toward the end of the election. Former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg supposedly spent $100 million in advertising for Joe Biden in Florida. So they will pay more attention to states that they think can wind up in their column in the Electoral College than they might otherwise.
Does the Electoral College system also have an impact on how legislators behave in between elections, too? Like, what kind of an impact might that have on lawmakers if we got rid of it?
Well, I think what would happen is not, it would be indirect. It would really depend on what a president proposes. If we didn't have an electoral college and elected our presidents by a nationwide majority, say, you might expect the incumbent president to be proposing legislation that would appeal to the largest portions of the population numerically, rather than might have an impact in some states, but a lesser impact in others. And Congress then, in turn, would react to those proposals.
Marjorie Hershey, do people who oppose the Electoral College just want it gone, or do they want it changed? And what would be the ways that could happen? We just have a few minutes left.
Well, I think a number of people would love to have it gone. I think a lot of people would be just as satisfied if the Electoral College were better able to reflect the difference of votes within the population as a whole, so that either, for example, Indiana's electoral votes, our 11 electoral votes, were divided up according to the percentage of the popular vote that the Republican and the Democratic candidates got. So maybe the Republican candidate would get 7 votes and the Democrat would get 4. That shows you right away how difficult it would be to get a change like this accepted, because that would mean that the dominant party in the state, the Republicans, would no longer be getting all 11 votes from Indiana. They'd only be getting 7, and voluntarily giving up 4 electoral votes to the Democrats doesn't sound like a real sensible thought for the Republican Party. Another possibility is the compact that says each state that signs it would agree to give all of its electoral votes to the candidate who won the popular vote overall, and that has the same problems. The very partisan impact of the Electoral College shows why it's going to be so difficult to get rid of it.
Isn't it, though, wouldn't that delay the results of the election, given, I mean, the news of the last week, the very, very complicated year that we've had has delayed the results, or not has, but did delay the results of this election. Would splitting things up like that do the same?
Well, certainly that would be the case, because of the fact that we would need every popular vote counted, presumably, before we declared a victor, although we don't really have that problem now in most states. That we've already called a whole bunch of states that have already completed maybe 90% or 95% of their vote counting. Frankly, that's one of the arguments that I believe Professor Lenkowski was mentioning earlier about the fact that recounts would be a lot harder if we had a total popular vote system, because they could be called anywhere, whereas now they're limited to the states where there seem to be some issues. Frankly, I don't think that this particular election is one of them. I mean, the election has been decided. The only reason that we don't have a winner right now is a whole bunch of frivolous lawsuits that are being filed by the candidate that lost.
We're talking with two experts about the impact of the Electoral College on U.S. elections and the arguments for and against it. I'm Matt Pelzer. We're back with more in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Back now to our discussion on the Electoral College with Marjorie Hershey, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Indiana University, and Leslie Lenkowski, Professor Emeritus in Public Affairs and Philanthropy at Indiana University. And Professor Lenkowski, we have a comment from Benjamin on Twitter that I'd like for you to respond to. Ben says, it really can't be emphasized enough that simply living in a large city or a rural area doesn't automatically determine one's political views. Now more than ever, we are a transient society, and those views don't shift just because we cross a city or state boundary. Any comments on Benjamin's tweet?
Well, I think that's certainly true, and we've seen lots of changes in the electorate. It used to be the case, to take the most obvious example, that the southern states were reliably Democratic. Now they're not. They might be called semi-reliably Republican, but as we saw in Georgia, as we saw in Florida, to some degree the closeness in places like Texas, population shifts, including people moving into those states, have started to change. North Carolina is another good example of that, even though it looks like President Trump will eventually carry North Carolina. It was a lot closer, I think, than one might have thought if one thought the South was now reliably Republican.
We have a listener voicemail from Dorothy who has a question about one potential change within the electoral system. Let's listen.
Hello, my name is Dorothy. I'm calling from Indianapolis. I'd like to know what the speakers think it would take, or how we could go about changing the proportionment so that, like Nebraska and Maine, that each state, or in particular Indiana's, is divided up the number of electors vote according to the breakdown in the state of votes for each of the candidates. Thank you.
Marjorie, how could Indiana do that to make ourselves our system a little more like Maine or Nebraska?
Well, we could do it fairly easily. The question is, will we? Dorothy points out another of the ways in which we could take the existing Electoral College and adapt it so that it comes closer to reflecting the popular vote. The question is, who has the motivation to do that? That would mean that in some districts, for example, in the congressional district around Indianapolis, the chances are excellent that that electoral vote would go to the Democratic presidential candidate. What would motivate a Republican-dominated state legislature with a veto-proof Republican majority to give one of the 11 electoral votes from Indiana to a Democratic candidate? It's important for us to understand that there are differences between the theoretical value of something and the empirical likelihood that it happens in a political system that is highly partisan and highly polarized.
And it all might also be, I agree with what Professor Hershey just said, but it might also be worth keeping out that pointing out that people don't live in congressional districts, which they've chosen on party lines. So in, say, Indianapolis, while it might be able to cast an electoral vote for one candidate, there'd be lots of other people in that district who would feel aggrieved.
Leslie, do you think it's plausible that the Electoral College could be removed? I understand it would take a lot of effort, but is it possible?
Yeah, I think it is possible. As I said, in 1968, one of the houses of Congress passed an amendment by a very large majority to do exactly that. But 1969 was 50 years ago. We haven't seen anything that close. Incidentally, one of the advocates for this kind of change was Indiana's own Senator Birch Bayh. He made an effort in the 1970s. It didn't get quite as far. So it's possible, but I suspect there are a lot of other things that members of Congress are paying attention to these days.
Marjorie Hershey, I spoke with a political science professor recently who seemed to suggest, and there may be competing theories out there on this, and I'd like to know what you think. He seemed to suggest that when we look a little further into the future, maybe 15, 20 years from now, he seems to think that there may be a shift in who the Electoral College might favor. Right now, it seems to be favoring Republicans, but he seems to think that the shift may turn to Democrats. How possible do you think that is?
Well, I think the electorate as a whole will probably become, increasingly Democratic. That's simply because of the fact that demographically, the United States population is changing. And it's probably changing faster than we have ever experienced a change before. We have a great increase in the percentage of the electorate who are Latino Americans and Black Americans. And that increase has meant that the overall voting population, which used to be about 85% non-Latino white 50 years ago, is in this most recent election probably about 65% non-Latino white. So that means that the kinds of groups that have supported the Democrats in the past are growing, and the kinds of groups that have supported Republicans in the past are declining. That doesn't necessarily guarantee that Democrats will gain all of those Latino and Black American votes. We saw in the most recent election that about a third of Latino voters and maybe about 15% of Black voters supported Republicans. And there are some who argue that Latino voters are particularly likely to become more Republican over time. as they become more established in American politics. But as to whether or not the Electoral College becomes more Democratic or Republican, well, that means whether or not the individual states are likely to change in their demography. We've seen some change. Georgia has become a much more minority-majority state now than it used to be, and so it's become more Democratic. Texas may be the next state to go, but I would really not hold my breath to see North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, or Alabama, and other Deep South states moving with any speed within 15 years or maybe within 40 years to the Democratic Party.
But I think it's important to keep in mind that the Electoral College gives strong incentives to partisans of any stripe to try and appeal to minorities within states. Again, we saw this in Florida, where the Republican Party made a strong effort aimed at Cuban Americans and did well enough to carry the state handily as a result. So there's a dynamism here that changing demographics does not always account for.
We do have a couple of voicemails I want to make sure we get to. Our first one is from Andy, who has a comment on how nuanced our representation should be.
This is Andy D. from Indianapolis. The craziest thing about the Electoral College is that it is based on the Senate and really reveals the fundamentally undemocratic nature of the Senate. You have crazily disproportionate representation between, you know, California's two senators and, you know, the states with the same population that, you know, comprise 46 senators in the caucus. And that's exacerbated by the Apportionment Act of 1929, which permanently fixed the House of Representatives at 435 people, when the constitutional minimums of 30,000 people per representative, you'd have a House of Representatives that was over 11,000 people. Imagine the nuance you could have in representation if you had a House of Representatives with 11,000 people. But of course, that would greatly skew the Electoral College power away from the Senate and more toward the actual representative republic that we're supposed to have. Thank you.
Marjorie Hershey, how might we respond to Andy's comments?
Well, we might respond to Andy's comments that there is always a balance involved in these things. I think that Andy is absolutely right in his diagnosis of the problems of the lack of majoritarianism in our representation right now. The challenge here is that we can all kind of have some interesting thoughts about what it would be like to sit in a House of Representatives with 11,000 people in it. If we have greater representation, the trade-off is that we probably have more difficulty reaching agreement on a particular proposal. And that's sort of what democracy is all about. It's a whole bunch of trade-offs, and it's not as though we get to choose the perfect one. It's that we get to choose the least imperfect one, maybe somewhere in between. But 11,000 representatives, goodness, we have enough trouble, you know, in families deciding what flavor to get for the pizza, much less if you were to multiply that by about 4,000 times.
It might also be worth pointing out that the Senate has grown increasingly Democratic over our history. Direct election of senators was one example of this. But also, if you look at the job of a senator now, they spend, even though they have much longer terms, 6-year terms, they spend a lot more time than they used to spend trying to stay abreast of views within their states.
Leslie, I want you to respond to this listener voicemail from Dean, who's asking about the Electoral College in the 1960s. Let's listen.
Hi, my name is Dean, calling from Indianapolis. I was interested in hearing the opinion of the experts around some reporting that's been done recently by the New York Times as well as NPR, specifically that the reason the Electoral College has never gotten closer or did not actually pass in the late 60s after Nixon's narrow margin was because it was filibustered heavily by segregationists from the South because they saw their power being diminished and their position being trampled by a majority who thought that segregation needed to be abolished and that the abolishment of the Electoral College would actually take away some of the state's ability to kind of impose such draconian measures on the population at large. Should it have been actually eliminated in the late 60s? Thanks so much.
Leslie, what about that filibuster by segregationists in the late 60s?
Well, I think it's also it's important to remember that by 1969, the major civil rights bills had been enacted. We weren't quite in the era of Strom Thurmond anymore, at least Strom Thurmond, the segregationist. I haven't checked lately, but I recall, I think it is certainly true that more conservative senators probably opposed this change in the Electoral College, but that's because they had put a priority on certain aspects of the Electoral College as opposed to majoritarian vote. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that the senator who was most associated with opposing this change was a man named Roman Hruska, who I think represented Nebraska, if I remember correctly.
Yes, that's right.
And so, you know, I don't think it's quite simply a segregationist effort. Certainly it is a more conservative, but there were probably also, I know Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, a liberal from New York, opposed changing the Electoral College. So this cuts across the traditional party and ideological lines.
You know,
Marjorie,
Let me just add to that, that perhaps our listeners can gain one very important lesson from all of this, and that's a truth in politics. The rules always determine the outcome. The rules are never neutral. Whatever rules we choose, whether it's a three-point shot in basketball or the Electoral College in politics, make a huge difference in terms of people's behavior and in terms of what actually does result from that behavior. So it's good to keep in mind whenever we see these kinds of prospective changes, don't just dismiss them and think, oh, that's just, you know, a matter of technicalities. It's never technicalities. It's always the outcome.
Marjorie Hershey, we have a couple of minutes left, and I'd like for you to respond to this question from Brent on Facebook, who asks, should we be talking about the issue of slavery and the concern of the slave states, quote unquote, regarding the formation of the Electoral College? How much is that a part of the conversation?
Well, you know, there's certainly been a long argument to the effect that whenever we see the southern states concerned about their representation at the formation of the republic, that slavery isn't very far away from the discussion. You know, we can talk about tradition and heritage all we want to, but the tradition was one of slavery, and that's something that needs to be recognized. I think that at this point, it's probably worth thinking more in terms of the current dynamics rather than how the Electoral College started. That's certainly a useful question, and I appreciate Brent's mentioning it, but we also need to talk about what's going to happen next.
Leslie, I'll ask you in the last minute that we have here. I mean, President-elect Biden is going to end up with a considerable lead against President Trump in the popular vote. Do you think that a candidate winning both the Electoral College and the popular vote this year might slow down these kinds of conversations about the relevancy of the Electoral College?
Well, they've been slow already, but certainly I think the argument that a candidate who wins the Electoral College may not have a majority. The popular vote will be false, as if you look at Joe Biden's victory. And so I don't think there'll be quite as much effort behind changing the Electoral College. There's not very much now.
I want to thank our guests for taking the time today. This has been a great conversation on the Electoral College. Leslie Linkowski is a professor emeritus in public affairs and philanthropy at Indiana University. Leslie Linkowski, thank you so much for your time and your expertise.
Thank you.
Marjorie Hershey is a professor emeritus of political science at Indiana University. Marjorie Hershey, always glad to have you, and thanks for stopping by today.
You're most welcome.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme. Our podcast can be found wherever you get podcasts. Tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about working mothers in the pandemic. In the meantime, you can find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. And, of course, download our All In Vox Pop app wherever you get apps. It allows you to keep track of what we're talking about, and it allows you to send us high-quality audio messages, which we can share during the show. We'd love to hear your voice in the next conversation that we have. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.